Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, a look at Syrian refugees. Until the courts put it on hold, President Trump's travel ban prevented Syrian refugees from entering the U.S. indefinitely. A few are once again finding asylum in America, but the scope of the humanitarian crisis in Syria is enormous. Today, a conversation about efforts to help displaced Syrians with representatives from Human Rights Watch, Catholic Relief Services, and the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Plus, the ACLU says that in the first weekend of the travel ban, it received 6 times more in donations than it normally receives in a year. The writer and producer David Simon is holding an event tonight at Beth Am Synagogue to support the ACLU and others who work on behalf of immigrants. He'll tell us about it today on Midday. First, the news. And good afternoon, everybody. Very glad you're with us today. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The civil war in Syria has led to one of the worst humanitarian crises since the Second World War. Since the conflict began 6 years ago, nearly 5 million people have fled to Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, and Iraq. More than 6 million others have been displaced from their homes but are unable to get out of Syria. 1 million people have requested asylum in Europe. The Obama administration committed to placing 10,000 Syrian refugees in the U.S. in 2016. Last month, as I'm sure you've heard, President Trump tried to ban all travel to and from Syria indefinitely. That ban was overturned, at least for the moment, by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals last Thursday night. Today, a conversation about what's happening on the ground and what we might be able to do to help the millions of people who are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. A little later in the show, I'll speak with the writer and producer David Simon about an event that he's holding tonight to raise money for various organizations that are opposing the Trump travel ban. Now I'm pleased to welcome 3 people whose organizations are at the front lines of the effort to aid people whose lives have been turned upside down by Bashar al-Assad, ISIS, and other actors in this brutal conflict, which is rife with unimaginable atrocities. Bill O'Keefe is the Vice President for Government Relations and Advocacy at Catholic Relief Services. They're based here in Baltimore. Mr. O'Keefe, welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
Linda Hartke is the CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, also based here in Baltimore. Ms. Hartke, welcome to you.
Good afternoon, Tom.
And Bill Frelick, he's the Director of the Refugee Rights Program at Human Rights Watch in Washington. Mr. Frelick, thank you.
Great to be here.
So Mr. Trump's proposed ban, bars people from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. The World Bank estimates that that totals about 218 million people, the populations of all of those countries. Bill O'Keefe, define for us what the difference is between an immigrant and a refugee. How does the international community define who a refugee is?
That's a great question, and something that's enshrined in international law. A refugee is somebody who is fleeing their country because of a fear of violence and persecution, to put it in English. And so lots of people who are migrants are not refugees. They're fleeing for economic reasons. They want a better life for their children, all legitimate. But a refugee very particularly is someone who is fleeing their country of origin because they're afraid for their lives and for their safety because of persecution, conflict, things like that.
And Bill Frelick, there are 5 basic reasons that people can be considered refugees. What are those reasons?
Race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group or political opinion. So there's what's called the nexus between that well-founded fear of being persecuted, and it's on one of these grounds that you've been identified in some way, you've been targeted in some way because of your identity, because of your beliefs. Most of these are pretty well understood. Questions like religion, which is part of the executive order, actually, that there'd be a preference for religion over the other 4 grounds. But the other 4 grounds are equally important. People's political opinions, their social group, they may be LGBT people that are being persecuted, people persecuted for race. And so the idea of preferencing one group over the others it doesn't really make any sense. I mean, you want to look at the severity of the persecution. You want to look at, for resettlement purposes, whether people can remain in the next door neighbor countries that you just talked about, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey in particular. And these are all legitimate considerations. And certainly religion is one of the grounds, and it's a very important ground, and people who are fleeing religious persecution ought to be protected. But that shouldn't exclude other people who have equally meritorious reasons for fleeing their countries and who need protection just as much.
So, Linda Harkey, Catholic Relief Services, the organization Bill is with, is working with people not in the United States. They're not resettling folks here in the U.S., but you are. So talk about your organization, and I understand you're sort of contracted by the State Department to take care of folks who are here in the United States. What's the scope of the problem? What's the scope of the numbers of folks you're dealing with, and how do you do what you do?
Well, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service is now more than 75 years old and has been welcoming newcomers to this country across those decades. We are part of a public-private partnership with the federal government in welcoming refugees now, helping them resettle in those early days as they get off to a new start in this country. But we also accompany refugees through what we call the long welcome, having a community of friends and supporters who surround them and are with a refugee family as they integrate, as they adapt to the culture, as they are employed, as
kids
get into
school. So you're matching
people.
You're matching families here in the U.S. with families or people from outside.
That's right. And being very attentive to where we place them around the U.S. Many of the refugees who come to the U.S. have a family connection here already. And of course, it's ideal that they be placed close to family. So in the last year, we resettled over 13,000 refugees in the United States in 45 different communities.
Very many here in Baltimore. I mean, your organization is based here in Baltimore, but that doesn't mean you're settling people here in Charm City necessarily.
That's right. Our national headquarters is here, but we have a network of partner organizations we work through. So we do resettle in Maryland, but not here in Baltimore.
Where are you settling most of the folks from Syria, for example?
The largest numbers are in Michigan, in Pennsylvania. I mean, Allentown, Pennsylvania is a remarkable place of welcome to Syrian refugees.
Yeah, big Syrian.
Fort Worth, Texas as well. So some surprising communities.
Mm-hmm. And Bill O'Keefe, what are you hearing from your folks on the ground in Syria and in these camps in Lebanon, Turkey, other places that you're working with?
Well, we hear every day just about the human suffering that has resulted from this now almost 6-year civil war in Syria. You will recall the city of Aleppo recently fell to government hands, and hundreds of thousands of people over time have been fleeing from that area into other parts of Syria and then into Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. If you take let's take Lebanon, for example. It's a country of about 4 million people. There's about 1 million refugees in Lebanon. That's about the equivalent of having 80 million refugees to the United States. That is an incredible...
Yeah, proportionally.
Proportionally, right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it gives you a sense of the scale of what that country has to face. And it's not a wealthy country. It's a poor country. I have had the opportunity to go myself to Lebanon and see some of the informal tent settlements in the Bekaa Valley between Syria and Lebanon. And the people in those settlements, you know, they're fleeing violence, they want to go home, and they're scared for their lives. And they are living in destitute situations. And the most desperate of those people are the ones who we have tended to settle in the United States. And that's why we care so much about this issue and why we connect the service that we're providing on the ground to 1.25 million people in this crisis to this executive order, because the most vulnerable people suffering from this situation are the ones who we have historically taken, and it's terrible that is being put at risk here.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. I'm joined here in Studio A by Bill O'Keefe from Catholic Relief Services, Bill Frelick from Human Rights Watch, and Linda Hartke from the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, which is based here in Baltimore, along with Catholic Relief Services. Bill Frelick, let me play you a clip of the president speaking about a week after his inauguration on the Christian Broadcasting Network.
You know, if you were a Christian in Syria, it was impossible, very, very, at least very, very tough to get into the United States. If you were a Muslim, you could come in. But if you were a Christian, it was almost impossible. And the reason that was so unfair is that everybody was persecuted, in all fairness, but they were chopping off the heads of everybody, but more so the Christians. And I thought it was very, very unfair. So we are going to help them.
This is the claim that others have made. Is there any truth to this statement that if you're a Muslim, you could get in, if you're a Christian, you could not? When we talk about religion being just one of five criteria for people to get refugee status, within religions, is there in fact preferential treatment for Muslims?
Not at all. In fact, the number of refugees globally that was resettled to the United States last year, if you combine Christians and other non-Muslim religions, exceeded the number of Muslims that were resettled to the United States. Also, the overstatement that if you were a Muslim, you could get in. I mean, if that was simply the case, you would have 5 million Syrian refugees here. We've admitted about 18,000 Syrian refugees total since the beginning of the conflict. Now, with respect to Syrian refugees per se, the numbers of Christians have been very small. It has been about 1%. But that also reflects the actual situation inside Syria and with Syrian refugees. As I said before, refugee resettlement is based on particular needs and vulnerabilities of people, oftentimes in the countries of first arrival. And many of the Christians have gone to Armenia, where they're welcome. They've gone to the Christian-controlled parts of Lebanon, where they've been welcomed by the Christian community there. And many of them have gone into Greece and into the European Union, Christian countries where they're not even eligible for resettlement to the United States because these are members of the European Union. And the Christian minority is a small minority to begin with within the country. So the resettlement breakdown in terms of religion reflects that to some degree. The other statement he made about chopping off heads is from everything we can tell from the evidence that's available, is just plain wrong. The Christians in Syria, for the most part, fled in advance of the ISIS advance. ISIS uses beheading, in fact, as a punishment for common crimes, including cigarette smoking, for example. But the people that are in the area that they control are overwhelmingly, almost exclusively, Sunni Muslims, which means that this punishment is being visited upon a Sunni Muslim population. To say that more Christians were beheaded than Muslims, there just is no evidence for that whatsoever. So the notion that now we have to favor, his conclusion is now we have to favor Christians over these other groups, really has no basis in the evidence that's available, the reality. And I can say from having worked in this field for 30 years and having been a watchdog on State Department processing and on the Department of Homeland Security interviewing, that there's no bias here. There's no discrimination against Muslim refugees, I mean against Christian refugees or Muslim refugees for that matter. In some respects, there are preferences actually. In the case of Iran, there are actual preferences for religious minorities, for Baha'is, Christians, Jews that are built into our system. But there's no intent to prevent Muslim refugees or Christian refugees or Baha'is or, you know, any other refugees from being admitted on that basis.
Linda Hartke, you're taking people from the Middle East, from Syria, and you're placing them in American communities, Greenfield, Michigan, Allentown, Pennsylvania. When you hear the term extreme vetting produced by or adduced by the Trump administration, what does that mean to you? And what's your response to those folks in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Maryland who are worried, who are nervous about people coming as refugees from places like Syria?
Well, first of all, it's perfectly legitimate for any American to be concerned for their safety, for the safety of their family, of their community, for any reason at all. We all long to be in a country and live in homes and neighborhoods that are safe. So that's reasonable, and that's a good place to start. But then one needs to explore the facts and the truth about how refugees are vetted. And refugees are the most vetted group of immigrants to this country by a long shot. The process that often takes up to 2 years to vet and screen a refugee before they come to the United States is, quite honestly, an enormous burden on refugees. It's a process that by default, if there's any question at all about a refugee, if they have a name that's similar to somebody on a watch list, their case goes on hold and they're not admitted to the United States. So the default is
one. So in your estimation, there's really no way that the vetting can get any more extreme than it already is.
I suppose it probably can. I think it will become more extreme in the amount of time it takes in layers of bureaucracy that are put on, but I'm doubtful that it will make a real difference in security for American citizens.
All right, we've got to take a quick break. We will come back. Linda Hartke is the CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service based here in Baltimore. Bill Frelick is the director of the Refugee Rights Program at Human Rights Watch. They're based in D.C. And Bill O'Keefe is the vice president for government relations and advocacy at Catholic Relief Services, also based here in Charm City. You are welcome to join us when we get back from this break. Our phone number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, if you want to drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. More on the Syrian refugee crisis after these words. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday with the Mayor. Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh will join me for the hour here in Studio A. She'll take your calls, comments, and questions, and I'm sure we'll talk about a wide range of important issues. The surge in violent crime, funding for the school system, possibility of increasing the minimum wage, and whatever else is on your mind. Mayor Catherine Pugh tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about the enormous humanitarian crisis in Syria. In a little bit, the writer and producer David Simon will join us to talk about an event that he's putting together tonight at Beth Am Synagogue. And by the way, looking ahead next month, the Pakistani novelist Mohsin Hamid will be my guest on Midday in advance of his March 11th event at the Church of the Redeemer in North Baltimore. That's another event which is going to try to raise some money to support organizations who work on behalf of immigrants and refugees. My guest today here in Studio A, Bill Frelick. He's the director of the Refugee Rights Program at Human Rights Watch. Linda Hartke, the CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. And Bill O'Keefe, the vice president for government relations and advocacy at Catholic Relief Services. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Bill O'Keefe, what's the scope of this problem worldwide? How many people are displaced, either inside the countries of origin or outside? What are we talking about? I mean, Linda talked about, you know, resettling some 13,000 folks, but that's just a drop in this very large bucket, is it not?
There are 65 million displaced people around the world right now, which is the highest number since the end of the Second World War. And of that 65 million, 20 million or so are refugees, as meeting the definition that we described earlier. And so the humanitarian community is extremely challenged to meet all those needs. And it's spread out around the world, of course. But as you mentioned, 11 million or so of these displaced people are from Syria itself. And it gives you a sense of why Syria, Iraq, and the countries of the Middle East are what we end up talking about so much. But we shouldn't forget Somalia, which is one of the seven countries on the list and from which hundreds of thousands of people have fled, South Sudan, Burma. Many countries have sent refugees and others are receiving them. And so the global burden of this humanitarian situation is overwhelming the capacity of governments receiving those people and agencies like my own that are trying to meet those needs.
And Bill Frelick, how do you respond to folks who say, look, we're putting a temporary hold on these countries, and part of the reason is that the countries are so unstable, there's no way we can do legitimate vetting of these people. I mean, Bashar al-Assad is not going to turn over information about people in Aleppo because he's the one who's persecuting them. You've made this point in an essay you wrote for The Hill. So should people worry about that? I mean, do we only accept refugees from sort of stable governments who can, you know, with complete accuracy and confidence ascertain a person's inclination to terrorism?
This gets back to your original question, the difference between an immigrant and a refugee. An immigrant is someone that, you know, you can choose to immigrate to this country for business reasons, family reasons, what have you. A refugee has no choice. A refugee is a person who's forced out of their home. Oftentimes, it's their own government that's persecuting them. And so, historically, it's certainly not been possible to have the government that's persecuting a person be the one to vouch for that person for the receiving state. You wouldn't call upon the Khmer Rouge that was committing genocide against Cambodians to vouch for them. You wouldn't call upon the Nazis, you know, to vouch for Jews that were trying to come and seek their lives, basically, in the United States and other places. And the refugee system recognizes that. It recognizes that these are people who have lost the protection of their government. That's why they are refugees in the first place. And so what we do, as Linda pointed out, is a very, very careful vetting procedure for people that are waiting in these refugee camps. And they will oftentimes be in those camps for years before they even get an interview with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
And it is possible to do without the cooperation of a government.
The U.S. has been doing it basically since the end of World War II, since the Refugee Act of 1980 went into effect, the post-Vietnam War era, basically. Since that time, there's not a single refugee that's been resettled to the United States that has been found to have committed a fatal act of, murder against an American citizen in the United States. Not one. And that's with, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees that have been resettled in this country. The chances of someone, after they're going through this extremely thorough vetting procedure that involves the FBI and National Counterterrorism Center, Department of Homeland Security, State Department, UNHCR does its own vetting before they even refer a case to the United States. After all that, these people are really clean as a whistle. And as Linda said, if there's any shade of doubt whatsoever, if the U.S. government cannot be assured that they know this person inside and out, that person's not admitted. They don't get here.
And that does happen. There
yes.
are people being refused entry for reasons that Linda suggested. I mean, if they can't just verify it, they don't take that chance. Let's go to the phones. Ellen in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, everybody. I would say it's probably close to 15 years ago, I was a volunteer translator for a group in Baltimore called Advocates for the Survivors of Torture and Trauma. And this is way before this refugee crisis, you know, that's going on now. But the so I would help translate, you know, and I worked on just a couple of cases there. But you know, I remember one woman, who came from Cameroon, and you know, she'd been raped, and I don't know, family members killed. I can't remember all the details, but she had to document somehow, the truthfulness of her claims in order to be considered a refugee at all. And it was quite a process. And then there was eventually, you know, we had to go to court and there was a hearing. And, so even back then, the idea of admitting somebody as a refugee, political refugee in this case, was overwhelming. You know, I can't imagine what super vetting would be if that was just like regular vetting.
Well, thanks for the call, Ellen. I appreciate it. Linda Harkey, if the Trump administration is wrong, as so many people suggest they are, about sort of casting this wide net to keep our country safe and to prevent any people with terrorist aspirations into the country, what is the best way to reduce the threat of terrorism here in the United States?
Well, I'm not an expert on international terrorism. I work in a humanitarian field, working here in the U.S., both with refugees and with local communities that receive them, people who are not afraid of their new neighbors. The United States government has an enormous security apparatus that they put to work every day to keep our country safe, to minimize threats. It's a huge investment of our taxpayer dollars to do that, and the president himself is expected to provide leadership for that. It's a huge mistake, however, to focus on a small program, the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program, which is already doing more vetting by many times over than any other aspect of admitting immigrants to this country.
And this approach of the Trump administration, it seems to me, has been tried before, has it not? I mean, there is something called the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, which is a Bush-era program, which sort of did the same kind of thing in this, in terms of it casting a wide net. But Bill Frelich, did it work?
No, it was found to be completely ineffective and was dropped precisely for that reason. So there certainly are legitimate needs to vet people and to vet them thoroughly, but there's no need to exaggerate the threats either. And to answer the question that you just posed to Linda in my way, I think that what the terrorists most want to see is polarization. They want to see a wedge, you know, driven between the Muslim world basically and the rest of the world, and they want a clash of civilizations, and nothing feeds their purposes better than to conflate refugees with terrorists and to conflate Muslims with terrorists and to create these sort of blocks of exaggerated fears and prejudices. That's exactly what the terrorists want. And I think what the refugee program has done has basically said, no, we understand these are people just like us. They're ordinary people. We thank God that we're not faced with those kinds of threats to our children and their lives. And we can relate to wanting to have safety for your children and wanting them to be able to go to school and live a decent life and become good, decent people, regardless of your religion. That's really not what this is all about. So I think, you know, to say that we have a common humanity as opposed to say that it's us and them is the answer to terrorism. And to make this about building walls and dividing is exactly what the terrorists want to achieve.
So we are playing into the hand of this ideology, Bill O'Keefe.
Yeah, I agree. And I would just add that there is a system, a global system, that helps meet these humanitarian needs. And that system has the neighboring countries carrying most of the burden. And in exchange for that, we play our little part of taking in the 10 or 15,000 Syrians and 85,000 or so, or I think it's 85,000 for this year originally planned. No, 110,000 projected for this year. And that's our part of the bargain. And if we don't fulfill our part of the bargain, then countries like Kenya, who are handling hundreds of thousands of Somalis, Uganda helping hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese and Lebanese and Jordanians and Turkeys helping millions of Syrians, they will start asking, why should they do the hard work if the richest, most powerful in the country in the world is unwilling to do its part?
And what chances do you give it of happening this year if the goal is somewhere between 100 and 110,000 people being taken in, given the change of administration as of the 20th of January? I mean, is that going to happen?
I hope it does. I really do. The executive order mandated that the ceiling be dropped from 110 to 50, and that part has not gotten enough discussion because, frankly, That is a big problem for refugees around the world and for the system as I described it, and the system's ability to sort of handle these most vulnerable people. So we hope that it does. We're all advocating for it. I want to tell you about one woman who I met 3 weeks ago in northern Iraq. She had fled Islamic State-controlled area the night before and had walked through a minefield because her 15-year-old daughter was coming of age and she was terrified she would be seized as a sex slave. That's the kind of person who we meet, who we think should be a candidate for resettlement, and we have no reason to be afraid of them.
It's just an unimaginable choice that some of these people, many of these people, almost all of them are faced with. It's really just almost impossible to conceive. Tom in Mount Vernon, welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon, everyone. I have a problem with this vetting thing. It seems like with the vetting, the government seems to choose people who are lawyers, doctors, brain surgeons, et cetera. But if people's being oppressed and terrorized by their own government, even if you're a laborer, you work in a factory or something, shouldn't you have just as much right to come to our country as anyone else?
Well, thanks for your call, Tom. Does that happen, Linda Harkey? I mean, do people take into consideration in the vetting process the occupation, the education level, the financial circumstances of the person?
No, within the system here in the United States, that's not a priority in the screening and the selection that's made for resettlement. That information is gathered because it helps organizations like ours integrate people, find a good place for them that will be a good fit in the U.S., but it's not a criteria for their resettlement.
Bill O'Keefe, who's actually on the ground in Syria, in Lebanon, in Turkey, in these camps helping? I mean, you guys are Catholic Relief Services, but is it all being done by, you know, nonprofit organizations, or are there other governments helping, for example, the government of Lebanon, which you mentioned is so highly stressed by this burden?
Well, the local governments are doing their part, and it's different in each country, and I won't bore you with, you know, kind of breaking that down, except to say that they are doing their part. You have nonprofits, a whole range of them, like Catholic Relief Services. But the really untold story are the local people and local organizations. For example, our Catholic Caritas partners on the ground, other faith-based partners, Islamic groups, you know, local mosques, local churches, local communities, and they are carrying the lion's share of the actual work that's going on. Most of the refugees are actually not in camps. They're integrated into cities and towns and in rural areas with other families, and they're getting help from the local communities. Our job is just to help those local communities. And I think sometimes we in the United States think, you know, that it's those of us international people who are doing all the work. It's really Muslims helping Christians, Christians helping Muslims, and people working together on the ground. That, to me, is the real untold story and the most inspiring thing.
Bill Frelich, your organization, Human Rights Watch, keeps track of human rights violations across the planet, including when they happen here in the United States. Is there any end in sight to the atrocities and the war crimes that Bashar al-Assad has been accused of? Is there any movement in terms of Russian-United States collaboration or collaboration with any other governments to stop the civil war there? I mean, 400,000 Syrians have been killed in this conflict in the last 6 years. It's carnage of unbelievable proportion.
Yeah, it is exactly what you said. I mean, it is carnage of unbelievable proportion. And my fear is that the new U.S. administration will somehow arrange with Russia and the Bashar al-Assad regime to sort of carve up Syria and declare safe areas, which is something that the surrounding countries have been very keen to want to relieve themselves of the burden that they face. It's, you know, the Turks have been pushing for it, the Lebanese have been pushing for it, the Jordanians have been pushing for it as well. And my fear is that they won't really be any more safe than they are now, that the fighting will continue, that you're not going to have, you know, blue helmets come in and really keep the sides apart, that they all have geopolitical motivations, all of the players involved, and that the refugees and the displaced people will suffer at the end because essentially it's going to be a containment strategy. And the EU will give it its blessing because they don't want them coming to the European Union. Trump has already given it his blessing. And it's exactly what those host countries want. Again, more walls as opposed to letting people in. We see right now on the Jordanian border, this place called the Berm, where they've bulldozed sand, and there are 75,000 plus Syrians that are stranded on the Syrian side of the border. We've got hundreds of thousands of Syrians that are stranded at the Turkish border, where they have now built a wall, and we've documented shooting asylum seekers that have tried to cross. So it's already happening. And the question now is, are we going to force people to remain inside this war zone and not give them the right to flee, to seek asylum, to seek safety, because the world community doesn't really care and it wants to look the other way. We just can't let them look the other way.
Bill Frelick is the director of the Refugee Rights Program at Human Rights Watch in D.C. Bill O'Keefe is the vice president for government relations and advocacy at Catholic Relief Services here in Baltimore. Linda Hartke is the CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, also based here in Baltimore. We will continue this discussion with you and others. I very much appreciate your time this afternoon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after a quick break, David Simon will join me. He's a writer and television producer of dramas like The Wire. He joins me to talk about an event tonight with Taylor Branch, DeRay McKesson, and others in support of immigrants. Before we take that break, it's our practice here on Midday to acknowledge those people in our city who have lost their lives to violence. Every Monday, we read the names of the people who were victims of a homicide in the previous week. So far, in the first 44 days of this year, 45 people have been killed in Baltimore. Last week, the following young men were victims of homicide. Dominic Marshall, age 21. Tyrone Donaldson, age 22. Davon Williams, age 28. Sherman Carruthers, age 42. And Deontay Bluford. He was 21 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.